Georgia Bellarmino would never have known if it hadn't been for the cereal box. Georgia was on the phone with a client in New York, an investment banker who had just gotten a DOE appointment. They were talking about the house he was buying for his family move to Rockville, Maryland. Georgia, who was best-selling realtor of the year in Rockville for 3 years running, was busy going over the terms of the purchase when her 16-year-old daughter, Jennifer, called from the kitchen. "Mom, I'm late for school. Where's the cereal?" "On the kitchen table." "No, it's not." "Look again." "Mom, it's empty. Jimmy must have eaten it." Mrs. Bellarmino covered the phone with her hand. "Then get another box, Jen," she said. "You're 16. You're not helpless." "Where is it?" Jennifer said, banging doors in the kitchen. "Look above the oven," Mrs. Bellarmino said. "I did. It's not there." Mrs. Bellarmino told the client she'd call back and walked into the kitchen. Her daughter was wearing low-cut jeans and a sheer top that looked like something a hooker would wear to work. These days, even junior high girls dress that way. She sighed. "Look above the oven, Jen." "I told you I did." "Look again." "Mom, will you just get it for me? I'm late." Mrs. Bellarmino stood firm. "Above the oven." Jennifer reached up, opening the doors, stretching for the cereal box, which was right there, of course. But Mrs. Bellarmino was not looking at the box. She was looking at her daughter's exposed stomach. "Jen, you have those bruises again." Her daughter brought the box down, tugged at her top, covering her belly. "It's nothing." "You had them the other day, too." "Mom, I'm late." She was walking to the table, sitting down. "Jennifer, show me." With an exasperated sigh, her daughter stood and lifted her top, exposing her abdomen. Mrs. Bellarmino saw an inch-long horizontal bruise just above the bikini line, and another one, fainter, on the other side of the belly. "It's nothing, Mom. I just keep banging into the edge of the desk." "But you shouldn't bruise. It's nothing. Are you taking your vitamins?" "Mom, can I please just eat?" "You know you can tell me anything. You know that." "Mom, you're making me late for school. I have a French test." There was no point in pushing her now. In any case, the phone had started ringing, no doubt the New York client telephoning back. Clients were impatient. They expected realtors to be available every minute of the day. She went into the other room to take the call and opened her documents to review the numbers. 5 minutes later, her daughter yelled, "Bye, Mom!" and Georgia heard the front door slam. It left her distinctly uneasy. She just had a feeling. She dialed her husband's lab in Bethesda. For once, Rob was not in meetings, and she was put right through. She told him the story. "What do you think we should do?" she asked. "Search her room," he said promptly. "We have an obligation." "Okay," she said. "I'll call the office and tell them I'll be late." "I'm flying later," he said, "but let me know." Barton Williams' Boeing 737 rolled to a stop at the Hopkins Private Terminal in Cleveland, Ohio, and the whine of the engines wound down. The interior of the aircraft was luxuriously appointed. There were 2 bedrooms, 2 full baths with showers, and a dining room seating 8. But the master bedroom, which took up the entire rear third of the plane, with a king-size bed and a fur throw and mood lighting, was where Barton spent most of the flight. He needed only 1 flight attendant, but he invariably flew with 3. He liked company. He liked laughter and chatter. He liked young, smooth flesh on the fur, with the mood lighting low, warm, reddish, sensual. And hell, 40,000 feet up in the air was the only place he could be sure he was safe from the wife. The thought of the wife dampened his mood. He looked at the parrot standing on the perch in the living room of the plane. The parrot said, "You kidnapped me." "What's your name again?" Barton said.
"Riley. Doghouse Riley,"
speaking in a funny voice.
Don't be smart with me.
My name is Gerard.
That's right, Gerard. I don't much like it. Sounds foreign. How about Jerry? That suit you?
No, the parrot said. It doesn't.
Why not?
It's stupid. It's a stupid idea. There was an uncomfortable silence.
Is it really? Barton Williams said with a hint of menace in his voice.
Williams knew this was a mere animal, but he was not accustomed to being called stupid, especially by a bird, and no one had done so in many, many years. He felt his enthusiasm for this gift cooling.
Jerry, he said, you better be getting along with me, because I own you now.
People can't be owned.
And you ain't people, Jerry. You're a damn bird.
Barton stepped close to the perch.
Now, let me tell you how it's going to be. I'm going to give you to my wife. And I want you to behave. I want you to be amusing. I want you to compliment and flatter her and make her feel good. Is that clear?
Everyone else does, Gerard said.
He was mimicking the voice of the pilot, who heard it from the cockpit and snapped his head around to look back.
Jesus, I get sick of the old fart sometimes, Gerard continued.
Barton Williams frowned. Next, he heard a precise imitation of the sound of jet engines in flight, and superimposed on that, a girl's voice, one of the flight attendants.
Jenny, are you going to blow him or am I?
Your turn.
Sigh. Okay. Don't forget to take him his drink.
Click of a door opening and closing. Barton Williams began to turn red. The bird continued.
Oh, Barton. Oh, give it to me. Oh, you're so big. Oh, Barton. Yes, baby. Yes, big boy. Ooh, I love it. So big. So big. Ah.
Barton Williams stared at the bird.
I believe, he said, that you will not be a welcome addition to my household. You're the reason our kids are ugly, little darling, Gerard said. That's enough from you, Barton said, turning away.
Oh, Barton, oh, give it to me. Oh, you're so big. Oh!
Barton Williams threw the cover over the bird's cage.
Jenny, honey, you've got family in Dayton, don't you?
Yes, Mr. Williams.
You think anybody in your family would enjoy a talking bird?
Well, actually, yes, Mr. Williams. I'm sure they would love it.
Good, good. I would appreciate it if you delivered him down there today.
Of course, Mr. Williams.
And if by some chance, he said, your family is not appreciative of feathered companions, just have them tie very heavy weights to his legs and drop him in the river, because I never want to see this bird again.
Yes, Mr. Williams.
I heard that, said the bird.
Good,
Barton Williams said. After the old man's limousine had gone, Jenny stood on the tarmac holding the covered cage.
What am I going to do with this thing? She said. My daddy hates birds. He shoots them.
Take him to a pet store, the pilot said, or give him to somebody who'll ship him to Utah or Mexico or someplace like that.
Refreshing Paws was an upscale store in Shaker Heights. There were mostly puppies in the store. The young guy behind the counter was cute, maybe a little younger than Jenny was. He had a good body. She walked in carrying Gerard in his covered cage.
You got any parrots?
No, we just have dogs, he smiled at her.
What have you got in there?
I'm Stan. His name tag said Stan Milgram.
Hi, Stan. I'm Jenny, and this is Gerard. He's an African gray.
Let's have a look at him, Stan said. You want to sell him or what?
Or give him away?
Why? What's the matter?
owner doesn't like him.
Jenny whipped off the cover. Gerard blinked, flapped his feathers.
I've been kidnapped, he said.
Hey, Stan said. He talks pretty good.
Oh, he's a good talker, Jenny said.
Oh, he's a good talker, Gerard said, mimicking her voice.
Then, stop patronizing me.
Stan frowned.
What's he mean?
I am surrounded by fools, Gerard said.
He just talks a lot, Jenny said, shrugging.
Is there anything wrong with him?
No, nothing.
Gerard turned to Stan.
I told you, he said emphatically, I've been kidnapped. She is involved. She is one of the kidnappers.
Is he stolen? Stan asked.
Not stolen, Gerard said. Kidnapped!
What kind of accent is that? Stan asked. He was smiling at Jenny. She turned sideways to show him her breasts in profile.
French?
He sounds British.
He came from France, is all I know.
Ooh la la, Gerard said. Will you please listen to me?
He thinks he's a person, Jenny said.
I am a person, you little twit, Gerard said. And if you want to hump this guy, go on and do it. Just don't make me wait around while you wiggle your assets in front of him.
Jenny turned red. The kid looked away, then smiled back at her.
He's got a mouth on him, Jenny said, still blushing.
Does he ever swear?
I never heard him do that, no.
'Cause I know someone who might like him, Stan said. As long as he doesn't swear.
What do you mean, someone?
My aunt, out in California. She's in Mission Viejo. That's Orange County. She's widowed, lives alone. She likes animals, and she's lonely.
Oh, okay. That could be okay.
You are giving me away? Gerard said in a horrified tone. This is slavery. I am not something you give away.
I have to drive out there, Stan Milgram said, in a couple of days. I could take him with me. I know she'd like him, but,
what are you doing later tonight?
I could be free, Jenny said.
The warehouse was located near the airport in Maiden. It had a skylight, so the lighting in the room was good, and the young orang in the cage appeared healthy enough, bright-eyed and alert. He seemed to have recovered completely from the darts. But Gourevitch paced back and forth, intensely frustrated, glancing at his watch. On the table nearby, his video camera lay on its side, the case cracked, muddy water draining out of it. Gourevitch would have taken it apart to dry it, but he lacked the tools. He lacked. Off to one side, Zanger, the network representative, said,
What are you going to do now?
We're waiting for another bloody camera, Gourevitch said.
He turned to the DHL rep, a young Malay man in a bright yellow uniform.
How much longer now?
They said within the hour, sir,
Gourevitch snorted.
They said that 2 hours ago.
Yes, sir, but the plane has left Bekasi and is on its way to us.
Bekasi was on the north coast of Java, 800 miles away.
And the camera is on the plane?
I believe so, yes.
Gourevitch paced, avoiding Zanger's accusatory stare. It was all a comedy of errors. In the jungle, Gourevitch had worked to resuscitate the ape for almost an hour before the animal showed signs of life. Then he had struggled to bind the animal and tranquilize it again, not too much this time, and then monitor the animal with care to prevent the creature from going into adrenaline shock while Gourevitch brought him north to Maiden, the nearest big town with an airport. The orang survived the journey without incident, ending up in the warehouse, where he cursed like a Dutch sailor. Gourevitch notified Zanger, who immediately flew in from New York. But by the time Zanger arrived, the ape had developed laryngitis and no longer spoke, except for a raspy whisper.
What the hell good is that? Zanger said. You can't hear him.
It won't matter, Gourevitch said. We'll tape him and then dub in his voice later, you know, lip-sync him.
You'll dub in his voice.
Nobody will know.
Are you out of your mind? Everybody will know. Every lab in the world will go over this video with sophisticated equipment. They'll spot a dub in 5 minutes.
All right, Gorevich said. Then we'll wait until he gets better.
Zanger didn't like that, either. He sounds quite ill. Did he catch a cold somewhere?
Possible, Gorevich said.
In fact, he was almost certain the ape had caught his own cold during the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. It was a mild cold for Gorevich, but appeared to be serious for the orang, who was now bent over in spasms of coughing.
He needs a vet. Can't, Gorevich said. He's a protected animal, and we stole him, remember?
You stole him, Zanger said, and if you're not careful, you'll kill him as well.
He's young. He'll recover.
And indeed, the following day, the ape was talking again, but coughing spasmodically and spitting up ugly yellow-green gobs. Gorevich decided he'd better film the animal now, so he went to get his equipment from the car, stumbled, and dropped the camera in a muddy ditch, cracked the case open, all this not 10 feet from the warehouse door. And, of course, in the entire city of Maiden, they did not seem to be able to lay their hands on a decent video camera, so they had had to fly one in from Java. They were waiting for the camera now, while the ape swore and hacked and coughed and spat at them from inside his cage. Zanger stood just out of range, shaking his head.
Christ, what a cock-up!
And once again, Gorevich turned to the Malay kid and said,
"How much longer?"
The kid just shook his head and shrugged. And inside the cage, the orang coughed and swore. Georgia Bellarmino opened the door to her daughter's bedroom and began a swift examination. The room was a mess, of course. Crumbs in the creases of the rumpled bed covers, scratched CDs on the floor, knocked over Coke cans beneath the bed, along with a dirty hairbrush, a curling iron, and an empty tube of self-tanner. Georgia pulled open the drawers of the bedside table, revealing a clutter of chewing gum wrappers, balled-up underwear, breath mints, mascara, photos from last year's prom, matches, a calculator, dirty socks, old issues of Teen Vogue and People, and a pack of cigarettes which didn't make her happy. Then to the dresser drawers, riffling through them quickly, feeling all the way to the back. Then the closet, which took her quite a while, a jumble of shoes and sneakers at the bottom, the cabinet under the bathroom sink, and even the dirty clothes hamper. She found nothing to explain the bruises. Of course, she thought, there was hardly any purpose to putting a hamper in the room, since Jennifer just dropped her clothes all over the bathroom floor. Georgia Bellarmino bent over and picked them up, not really thinking about it. That was when she noticed the streaks on the tile floor of the bathroom. Rubber streaks, faint, in parallel. She knew what had caused those streaks. A stepladder. Looking up at the ceiling, she saw a panel that provided an entrance to the attic. There were smudged fingerprints on that panel. Georgia went to get a stepladder. She pushed the panel aside, and needles and syringes tumbled out, clattering onto the floor. Dear God, she thought. She reached up into the attic space, feeling around. Her hand touched a stack of cardboard tubes, like toothpaste. She brought them out. They all bore medical labels. Lupron, Gonal F, Folistim. Fertility drugs. What was her daughter doing? She decided not to call her husband. He would get too upset. Instead, she took out her cell phone and dialed the school. In the Chicago offices of Dr. Martin Bennett, the intercom was buzzing, but Dr. Bennett paid no attention. The biopsy report was worse than he had expected, much worse. He ran his fingers along the edge of the paper, wondering how he would tell his patient. Martin Bennett was 55. He had been a practicing internist for nearly a third of a century and had delivered bad news to many patients in his day, but it never got easier, especially if they were young, with young children.
He glanced at the pictures of his sons on his desk. They were both in college now. Tad was a senior at Stanford, Bill was at Columbia, and Bill was pre-med. A knock on the door, and his nurse Beverly stuck her head in.
"I'm sorry, Dr. Bennett, but you weren't answering the intercom, and I thought it was important."
"I know. I was just trying to think how to put it." He stood up behind the desk. "I'll see Andrea now."
Beverly shook her head. "Andrea hasn't arrived," she said. "I'm talking about the other woman."
"What other woman?" Beverly slipped into the office and closed the door behind her. She lowered her voice.
"Your daughter," she said.
"What are you talking about? I don't have a daughter."
"Well, there's a young woman in the waiting room who says she's your daughter."
"That's impossible," Bennett said. "Who is she?" Beverly glanced at a note card.
"Her name is Murphy. She lives in Seattle. Her mother works at the university. She's about 28, and she has a toddler with her, maybe a year and a half, little girl."
"Murphy, Seattle." Bennett was thinking back. 28, you say? No. No. Impossible. He had had his share of affairs in college and even in medical school, but he'd married Emily almost 30 years ago, and since then the only times he had been unfaithful had been at medical conferences. True, that was at least twice a year in Cancun, in Switzerland, somewhere exotic, but he'd only started that about 10, 15 years ago. He just didn't think it was possible he'd have a child that old. Beverly said,
"I guess you never know for sure. Will you see her?"
"No."
"I'll tell her,"
Beverly said. She dropped her voice to a whisper.
"But we don't want her making a scene in front of the patients. She seems like she might be a little, unstable. And if she's not your daughter, maybe you should set her straight in private."
Bennett nodded slowly. He dropped back into his chair. "Okay," he said. "Show her in."
"Big surprise, huh?"
The woman standing in the doorway, bouncing a child in her arms, was an unattractive blonde of medium height, wearing jeans and a T-shirt, grunge clothes. Her baby's face was dirty, dripping snot.
"Sorry I didn't dress for the occasion, but you know how it is."
Bennett stood behind his desk. "Please come in, Miss,
Murphy. Elizabeth Murphy."
She nodded to the baby.
"This is Bess."
"I'm Dr. Bennett." He waved her to the seat on the other side of the desk. He looked at her closely as she sat down. He saw no resemblance at all, not the slightest. He himself was dark-haired, fair-skinned, slightly overweight. She was olive-complexioned, rail-thin, brittle, tense.
"Yeah, I know," she said. "You're thinking I don't look anything like you, but with my natural hair color and more weight, you can see the family thing."
"I'm sorry," Bennett said, sitting down. "But to be frank, I don't see it."
"That's okay," she said, shrugging. "I figure it must be a shock to you, my showing up at your office like this."
"It's certainly a surprise."
"I wanted to call ahead and warn you, but then I decided I should just come, in case you refuse to see me."
"I see. Miss Murphy, what makes you believe you are my daughter?"
"Oh, I'm yours, all right. There's no question about it."
She was speaking with an uncanny confidence. Bennett said, "Your mother says she knows me?"
"No."
"Ever met me?"
"God, no."
He gave a sigh of relief. "Then I'm afraid I don't understand."
"I'll come right to the point. You did your residency in Dallas? At Southern Memorial?"
He frowned. "Yes."
"All the residents had their blood typed, in case they were needed as emergency blood donors."
"That was a long time ago." He was thinking back. "About 30 years now."
"Yeah, well, they kept the blood, Dad."
Again, he heard that conviction in her voice. "Meaning what?"
She shifted in her seat. "You want to hold your granddaughter?"
"Not at the moment, thank you."
She gave a crooked smile. "You're not what I expected.
I thought a doctor would be more sympathetic. They've got more sympathetic people at the methadone clinic in Bellevue. Miss Murphy, he said, let me. But when I got off the drugs and I had this beautiful daughter, I wanted to make sense of my life. I wanted my baby to know her grandparents. And I wanted to finally meet you. It was time, Bennett decided, to cut this short. He stood up. Miss Murphy, you realize that I can have genetic testing done, and it will show... Yes, she said, I realize that. She tossed a folded sheet of paper onto his desk. He opened it slowly. It was a report from a genetic laboratory in Dallas. He scanned the paragraphs. He felt dizzy.
It says you are definitely my father, she said. One chance in 4 billion that you're not.
They tested my genetic material against your stored blood.
This is crazy, he said,
dropping back in his chair. I thought you would congratulate me, she said. It wasn't easy to figure it out. My mom was living in St. Louis 28 years ago. She was married at the time.
Bennett had gone to medical school in St. Louis.
But she doesn't know me. She had artificial insemination from an anonymous donor, which was you.
Bennett felt dizzy.
I figured the donor must have been a medical student, she continued, because she went to the clinic at the medical school, and they had their own sperm bank. Medical students donated sperm for money back then, right?
Yes, $25.
There you go. Good pocket money in those days. And you could do it, what, once a week? Go in there and pop off?
Something like that.
The clinic burned down 15 years ago, and all the records were lost. But I got the student yearbooks and searched them. Each year the class was 120 students, half female. That means 60 males. Eliminate Asians and other minorities, you have about 35 a year. Back then, sperm didn't keep for more than a year or so. I ended up with about 140 names to check. It went faster than I thought.
Bennett slumped down in his chair.
But you want to know the truth? When I saw your picture in the medical yearbook, I knew immediately. Something about your hair, your eyebrows.
She shrugged.
Anyway, here I am.
But this was never supposed to happen.
Bennett said, we were all anonymous donors, untraceable. No one would ever know whether we had children or not. And back then, our anonymity was a given.
Yeah, well, those days are over.
But I never agreed to be your parent. That's my point.
She shrugged.
What can I say?
I wasn't having a child. I was helping infertile couples so they could have a child.
Well, I'm your child.
But you have parents.
I'm your child, Dr. Bennett, and I can prove it in court.
There was a silence. They stared at each other. The baby drooled and squirmed. Finally, he said, why did you come here?
I wanted to meet my biological father.
Well, you've met him.
And I wanted him to fulfill his duties and obligations because of what he did to me.
So there it was, finally out on the table.
Miss Murphy, he said slowly, you'll get nothing from me.
He stood. She stood, too. The reason I'm an addict, she said, is because of your genes.
Don't be absurd.
Your father was an alcoholic. And you had drug troubles of your own. You carry the genes for addiction.
What genes?
AGS3, heroin dependence, DAT1, cocaine addiction. You have those genes, and so do I. You gave me those genes. You never should have donated defective sperm in the first place.
What are you talking about?
He said, suddenly agitated. This woman was clearly following a memorized script. He felt danger.
I donated sperm 30 years ago. There were no tests back then, and there is no responsibility now.
You knew, she snapped. You knew you had a problem with cocaine.
You knew it ran in your family, but you sold your sperm anyway. You put your damaged, dangerous sperm on the market, not caring who you infected.
Infected?
You had no business doing what you did. You're a disgrace to the medical profession, burdening other people with your genetic diseases and not giving a damn.
Through his agitation, he somehow found self-control. He reached for the door.
"Miss Murphy," he said, "I have nothing more to say to you."
"You're throwing me out?"
"You'll regret this," she said. "You'll regret this very, very much."
And she stormed out of the office. Feeling suddenly drained, Bennett collapsed into the chair behind his desk. He was in a state of shock. He stared at his desk, at the files for his waiting patients. None of it seemed to matter now. He dialed his attorney and explained the situation quickly.
"Does she want money?" the attorney said.
"I assume so."
"Did she tell you how much?"
"Jeff," Bennett said, "you're not taking this seriously."
"Unfortunately, we have to," the attorney said. "This happened in Missouri, and Missouri had no clear laws regarding paternity from artificial insemination back then. Cases like yours were never a problem until quite recently. But as a rule in paternity disputes, the court orders child support."
"She's 28.
"Yes, and she has parents. Still, she can make an argument in court. Based on this gene thing, she can claim reckless endangerment. She can claim child abuse and whatever else she can pull out of a hat. Maybe she'll get something from a judge. Maybe she won't. Remember, paternity rulings are stacked against males. Say you get a woman pregnant and she decides to have an abortion. She can do that without consulting you. But if she decides to give birth, you'll pay support, even though you never agreed to have a child with her. The court will say it's your responsibility not to have gotten her pregnant in the first place. Or suppose you do genetic testing on your kids and discover they're not yours. Your wife cheated on you. The court will still require you to pay support for kids that aren't yours."
"But she's 28 years old. She's not a child."
"The question is, does a prominent physician want to go to court on a case that involves not supporting his own daughter?"
"No," Bennett said.
"That's right. You don't. And she knows that. And I assume she knows Missouri law, too. So wait until she calls back, arrange a meeting, and call me. If she has an attorney, all the better. Make sure he comes. Meanwhile, fax me that genetic report she gave you."
"I'm going to have to pay her off."
"Count on it," the attorney said, and hung up.
The desk officer at the Rockville police station was an attractive, smooth-skinned black woman of 25. The desk plate read, "Officer J. Lowry." Her uniform was crisp. Georgia Bellarmino pushed her daughter close to the other side of the desk. She set the paper bag of syringes in front of the policewoman and said,
"Officer Lowry, I want to know why my daughter has these things, but she refuses to tell me."
Her daughter glared at her.
"I hate you, Mom."
Officer Lowry showed no surprise. She glanced at the syringes. She turned to Georgia's daughter.
"Were these prescribed to you by a physician?"
"Yes."
"Did they involve matters of reproduction?"
"Yes."
"How old are you?"
16.
"Can I see some ID?"
"She's 16, all right," Georgia Bellarmino said, leaning forward. "And I want to know..."
"I'm sorry, ma'am," the policewoman said. "If she is 16 and these drugs involve reproductive issues, you have no right to be informed."
"What do you mean, I have no right to be informed? She's my daughter. She's 16.
"That's the law, ma'am."
"But that law is for abortions. She isn't having an abortion. I don't know what the hell she is doing. These are fertility drugs. She's shooting up fertility drugs."
"I'm sorry. I can't help you on this."
"You mean my daughter is allowed to inject drugs into her body, and I am not allowed to know what is going on?"
Not if she won't tell you, no.
And what about her doctor?
Officer Lowry shook her head. He can't tell you either. Doctor-patient privilege.
Georgia Bellarmino collected the syringes and threw them back in the bag. This is ridiculous.
I don't make the laws, the policewoman said. I just enforce them.
They were driving home.
Honey, Georgia said, are you trying to get pregnant?
No.
Sitting there with her arms folded, furious.
I mean, you're 16. That shouldn't be a problem. So what are you doing?
You made me feel like an idiot.
Honey, I'm just concerned.
No, you're not. You're a nosy, evil bitch. I hate you and I hate this car.
It went on like this for a while, until finally Georgia drove her daughter back to school. Jennifer got out of the car, slamming the door.
And you made me late for French!
It was an exhausting morning, and she had canceled 2 appointments. Now she had to try and reschedule the clients. Georgia went into the office, set the bag of needles on the floor, and started dialing. The office manager, Florence, walked by and saw the bag.
Wow, she said. Aren't you a little old for this?
It's not me, Georgia said irritably.
Then, not your daughter?
Georgia nodded.
Yeah.
It's that Dr. Van Dyckian, Florence said.
Who?
Down in Miami. These teenage girls take hormones, pump up their ovaries, sell their eggs to him and pocket the money.
And do what?
Georgia said.
Buy breast implants.
Georgia sighed. Great, she said. Just great. She wanted her husband to talk to Jennifer, but unfortunately Rob was on a flight to Ohio, where they were making a TV segment about him. That discussion, which was sure to be fiery, would have to wait. Riding the underground tram from the Senate office building to the Senate dining room, Senator Robert Wilson, Democrat Vermont, turned to Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat California, and said,
I think we ought to be more proactive on this genetic thing. For example, we should consider a law that would prevent young women from selling their eggs for profit.
Young girls already doing that, Bob, Feinstein said. They sell their eggs now.
Why? To pay for college?
Maybe a few. Mostly they do it to buy a new car for their boyfriend or plastic surgery for themselves.
Senator Wilson looked puzzled.
How long has that been going on? He said.
A couple of years now, Feinstein said.
Maybe in California.
Everywhere, Bob. A teenager in New Hampshire did it to make bail for her boyfriend.
And this doesn't trouble you?
I don't like it, Feinstein said. I think it's ill-advised. I think medically the procedure has dangers. I think these girls may be risking their reproductive futures. But what would be the basis for banning it? Their bodies, their eggs.
Feinstein shrugged. Anyway, the boat sailed, Bob, quite a while ago.
Not again.
Ellis Levine found his mother on the second floor of the Polo Ralph Lauren store on Madison and 72nd. She was standing in front of the mirror, wearing a cream-colored linen suit with a green scarf. She was turning this way and that.
Hello, dear, she said when she saw him. Are you going to make another scene?
Mom, he said, what are you doing?
Buying a few things for summer, dear.
We talked about that, Ellis said.
Just a few things, his mother said. For summer, do you like the cuffs on these pants?
Mom, we've been here before.
She frowned and fluffed her white hair absently.
Do you like the scarf? She said.
I think it's a bit much.
We have to talk,
Ellis said.
Are we having lunch?
The spray didn't work, he said.
Oh, I don't know. She brushed her cheek. I felt a little moisturization for about a week afterward, but not a great deal, no.
And you kept shopping.
I hardly shop at all anymore.
$3,000 last week. Oh, don't worry. I took a lot of those things back. She tugged at the scarf. I think that green does a funny thing to my complexion. Makes me look sick. But a pink scarf might be nice. I wonder if they have this in pink. Ellis was watching her intently, with a growing sense of foreboding. Something was wrong with his mother, he decided. She was standing at the mirror in exactly the same place she had been weeks before, when she showed a total indifference to him, to his message, to her family situation, to her financial situation. Her attitude was completely inappropriate. As an accountant, Ellis had a horror of people who were inappropriate about money. Money was real. It was tangible. It was hard facts and spreadsheet figures. Those facts and figures were not a matter of opinion. It didn't depend on how you looked at it. His mother was not recognizing the cold reality of her financial situation. He watched her smile, asking the salesgirl if the scarf came in pink. No, the salesgirl said. He didn't make pink this year. They only had green or white. His mother asked to try the white. The salesgirl walked away. His mother smiled at him. Very inappropriate, almost as if... It might be early dementia, he thought. It might be the first sign.
Why are you looking at me that way?
What way, Mom?
I'm not crazy.
You're not putting me in a home.
Why would you even say that?
I know you boys want the money.
That's why you're selling the condos in Vail and the Virgin Islands. For the money. You're greedy, the bunch of you. You are like vultures waiting for your parents to die. And if we won't die, you'll hurry it up. Put us in a home. Get us out of the way. Get us declared insane. That's your plan, isn't it?
The salesgirl came back with a white scarf. His mother draped it around her neck, flung it over her shoulder with a flamboyant gesture.
Well, Mr. Smartypants, you're not putting me in any home. You get that through your head right now.
She turned to the salesgirl.
I'll take it, she said, still smiling.
The brothers met that evening. Jeff, who was handsome and had connections in every restaurant in town, got them a table near the waterfall at Sushi Hana. Even early, the place was packed with models and actresses, and Jeff was making plenty of eye contact. Annoyed, Ellis said, "How are things at home?" Jeff shrugged.
"Fine. Sometimes I have to work late, you know."
"No, I don't. Because I'm not a big investment banker and the girls don't wink at me like they wink at you." Aaron, the youngest brother, the lawyer, was talking on his cell phone. He finished, flipped it shut. "Knock it off, you two. It's the same conversation you've been having since high school.
What about Mom?"
Ellis said, "It's what I told you on the phone. It's spooky. She's smiling and happy. She doesn't care. $3,000 last week. She doesn't care. She's buying more than ever."
"So much for that gene spray," Aaron said. "Where'd you get that anyway? Some guy works at some company in California? Biogen?"
Jeff had been looking over his shoulder. Now he turned back to the table.
"Hey, I heard something about Biogen. They've got some problems."
"What do you mean, problems?" Aaron said.
"Some product of theirs is contaminated. Earnings are down. Did something sloppy, made a mistake, I can't remember. They got an IPO coming up, but it'll tank for sure."
Aaron turned to Ellis.
"You think that spray you got is affecting Mom?"
"No, I don't think so. I think the damn stuff just didn't work."
"But if they had contamination," Aaron said.
"Stop being a lawyer. Some cousin of Mom's, her son, sent it as a favor to us."
"But gene therapy is dangerous," Aaron said. "There have been deaths from gene therapy. Lots of them."
Ellis sighed.
"Aaron," he said, "we're not suing anybody. I think we're looking at the start of, you know, mental deterioration. Alzheimer's or something."
"She's only 62.
It can start that early. Aaron shook his head.
Come on, Ellie. She was in perfect health. She was sharp. Now you're telling me she's losing it. It could be the spray.
Contamination, Jeff reminded them. He was smiling at a girl. Jeff, will you fucking pay attention?
I am. Look at the rack on her.
They're fake. You just like to ruin everything. And she has a nose job.
She's beautiful.
She's paranoid, Ellis said.
You don't know that.
I'm talking about Mom, Ellis said. She thinks we're going to put her in a home. And we may have to, Aaron said. Which will be very expensive. But if we do, it's because of that genetics company. You know the public has no sympathy for these biotech companies. Public opinion polls run 92% against them. They're perceived as unscrupulous scumbags indifferent to human life. GM crops, trashing the environment, patenting genes, grabbing up our common heritage while no one is looking, charging thousands of dollars for drugs that cost pennies, pretending they do research when they really don't. They just buy other people's work, pretending they have high research costs when they spend most of their money on advertising, and then lying in the advertising. Sneaky, scummy, sloppy, money-grabbing schmucks. It'd be a slam-dunk case.
We're not talking about a lawsuit, Ellis said. We're talking about Mom. Jeff said,
Dad's fine. Let him deal with her.
He got up and left the table, going over to sit with three long-legged girls in short skirts.
They can't be more than 15, Ellis said, wrinkling his nose.
They've got drinks on the table, Aaron said.
He has two kids in school.
How are things at home? Aaron said.
Fuck you!
Let's stay on the topic, Aaron said. Maybe Mom's losing it, and maybe she's not. But we're going to need a lot of money if she goes into a home. I'm not sure we can afford it.
So what are you saying?
I want to know more about Biogen and that gene spray they sent us. A lot more.
You sound like you're already planning the lawsuit.
Just thinking ahead, Aaron said.